should you do it? This is important. So the Imam alayhi salam is reported to have said that whenever difficulty or distress or circumstances, you know, that are troubling befall you, in this instance, seek assistance. Right, so seek assistance. The Imam is commanding here. فَاسْتَعِينُ, seek assistance, bina. So seek assistance by means of us, the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, towards who? Allah. Towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in order for your distress, your difficulties, your problems, all of it to go away. Or to find a resolve to it. Or even, not that, you know, you will find a cure for it, or you'll find a resolution to the problem that is in front of you. This is one particular solution that may occur, or even finding a solution. Rather, what may occur in this instance, that if a person, by means of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, by remembering the problems of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, by remembering the hardships that befell the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, they will be able to gain patience with dealing with the particular problem that is in front of them. And this then also will, according to some of the great ulama and the great scholars, allow a person to earn a greater proximity towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For it is via difficulty that a person gets closer to the object. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, firstly, to grant us the ability to recognize the Imam, to grant us the ability to go for the ziyarah and the visitation of this Imam, inshaAllah, and to grant us his intercession on the Day of Judgment. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The spotlight.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kabitafwai. When it comes to the Caucasus, Iran has made its stance clear. The Islamic Republic of Iran is deeply concerned by Israel's presence in this region and will not accept a map change. Iran's foreign minister made the remarks in the presence of his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, in Moscow. Meanwhile, Iran's leader has also said that the interference of foreign actors in the region is a source of discord and damage, calling on regional states to follow the example of Iran for power and rationality. Stay tuned to The Spotlight.
Israel's divisive activities in the region have always been a matter of concern for Iran, given the regime's hostility towards the Islamic Republic over the past decades. Recently, such concerns have grown further amid Israel's ever-expanding military ties with Azerbaijan. Israel has turned into a major arms supplier to the Caucasus nation in the wake of last year's flare-up of tensions between Azerbaijan and Armenia over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Iran sees Israel's nexus and arms deal with Baku as an attempt to establish a presence in the South Caucasus, which Tehran says will undermine regional stability and security. Iranian officials, including President Ibrahim Raisi, have warned that Tehran does not tolerate the regime's military presence in the region. Such a stance was among major topics highlighted by Iran's top diplomat during his visit to Russia.
We certainly never accept any geopolitical change and map change in the Caucasus. We have serious concerns about the presence of terrorists and Zionists in the region.
Last week, the Iranian armed forces launched a massive drill near the border with Azerbaijan to boost the country's defense and deterrent capabilities in the face of potential enemy threats. Military officials said the exercise was also a warning to Israel, a message that has been echoed by experts.
This latest exercise is very significant because it's sending out a clear message that Iran is not going to be passive. They're going to proactively be hunting and seeking out any forces which are trying to violate the stability of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Such warnings stem from Israel's hostile approaches, which include the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists and attacks on the country's nuclear facilities. Besides, Israeli officials have time and again threatened Iran with military action, a move Iran says will be met with a crushing response.
Our guest joining us for the spotlight is Saeed Mohsen Abbas. He's a journalist and political commentator who joins us from London. Also joining us, Saeed Mustafa Khoshchesh, political analyst. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, Saeed Mustafa Khoshchesh, and if you can quickly rewind back to a week ago where it seems that's a point where you had these military drills that were held by Iran in the northwestern border area. Tell us why Iran did that and what that situation is in the Caucasus that is a matter of concern at this point.
Hello, Kanavan. Thanks for having me. Well, you know, it all started last year. We hoped that, you know, Azerbaijan would suffice to take him back, Karabakh. But in a final deal, it was mentioned that there would be an exchange of corridors for Armenia and also Azerbaijan and southern Armenia. They would be given an economic corridor in order to be connected to their Nakhchivan region. But gradually, they were provoked by Israel, that's looking very much, as your report said, for escalating tensions between Iran and its neighbors as part of its plot against Iran to weaken Iran, to open up a corridor, to capture and occupy southern Armenian territory in order to be linked to Nakhchivan and then to Turkey. And then, you know, this is also pursued by the neo-Ottoman ambitious plans of Mr. Erdogan to open up such a corridor to go through Azerbaijan to the Caspian Sea, and then from there to Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, to Western China. There are Turkish territories. I mean, different kinds of ethnic Turks live in there. So they meant to open up such a territory. That would inflict much harm to Iran's not only national trade with Armenia or its link to, you know, to the Eurasian territories and countries and Europe, but also to the transit, the international corridor, south-north corridor that starts outside Iran, southeast Iran, and goes through Iran to Armenia, to Eurasia, and Russia, and Europe. And if such occupation happens, then Iran would have no border with Armenia, and then it's not just economic losses, huge economic losses that would be inflicted on Iran due to the rivalries, regional rivalries, that those who would occupy this territory would have with Iran, but also it would inflict a very huge geopolitical risks and threats to Iran, and it's not just Iran, but also to other regional states. Mm-hmm. Even Russians have a lot to lose if such a thing happens. So Iranians have been very much serious about standing against any such ambitious plan to capture Armenia, mm-hmm. southern Armenia, the same way that Iranians were serious about taking back Karabakh, helping Azerbaijan take back its occupied Karabakh territory.
Well, let's see here. So, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, you have the explanation there given by Saeed Mustafa Khoshchesh, and then you had Iran hold military drills, of which then it came out and said, and this is going back to the Iranian foreign minister, quote, the Islamic Republic of Iran does not tolerate the presence and activities of the Zionist regime against its national security. and will take any necessary action in this regard. So then you had this come out, and it took some by surprise. If you can explain to us why the Iran has made this statement, what is going on there?
Well, what the Iranian intelligence clearly has picked up quite some time ago is that after the Nagorno-Karabakh victory, essentially, for Azerbaijan, what they began to do was to allow Zionist Israeli contractors, Israeli companies, to become involved in the reconstruction of the regions that were won during this clash between the Azerbaijanis and the Armenians. Now, that is going to be an absolute red line. Everybody would know that. And the fact of the matter already is that Israeli drones are being stationed in that territory. And it's also alleged that, even more seriously, that a recent attack, terrorist attack, on a northern installation, nuclear installation within Iran, it's being intimated that actually it could well be such a territorial, if you like, gifts which Azerbaijan is giving to its Israeli collaborators, which could be causing major problems already in terms of Islamic Republic of Iran's internal security. Of course, all these things need to be verified, and there are claims and counterclaims going on. What is a fact, though, is that Azerbaijan gets 60% of its military hardware and its arms from Israel. What is a fact is that the Azeris provide 40% of Israel's oil, if you like, supplies. There are many, many more economic ties which are there. The Azeris, by and large, have tried to keep this very much undercover up to now. They not really openly declared their love affair with Israel. But you see, of course, Iran cannot ignore such a major, if you like, threat to its strategic safety, if you like, geostrategic safety, as to allow not only the Zionists into that territory, but also what's being alleged and is very, very likely to be true, is that the forces hitherto operating, for instance, in Syria, in Idlib, now have a direct rat run from Turkey into this region of Nagorno-Karabakh. And that, of course, means that ISIS and their sort of offshoots can embed themselves on the northern borders of Iran too. And this, of course, is yet another major threat. And I think this is why Ayatollah Khamenei, I mean, I'm going to quote, he says, those who dare under illusions of relying on others, thinking that they can provide their security, should know that they will soon receive a slap, that they will regret this. Now, that's really tough talk from the leader himself. And I think in retaliation, one of the things that we hear is that a mosque, a Husseiniya in Baku, has been closed down. The Azerbaijanis now claim it's because of the coronavirus, but the office of the Ayatollah Khamenei was also evidently shut down. So there are these exchanges going on. Iran itself has shut down military airspace for Azerbaijani military aircraft across its kind of airspace. So there is a sort of a very serious amount of, if you like, warning and saber rattling going on from Iran, saying, look, there are huge red lines, and Mr. Ilham Aliyev, the president of Azerbaijan, needs to take serious note.
Yeah, and when you talk about Iran's leader there and the statement that he made, say, Mohsen Abbas, let me ask you, Mostafa Khoshesh, Iran's leader has been very careful in the way that he's addressed this issue. And I'm going to take another quote where he said, the interference of foreigners in the region is a source of discord and damage. All issues and incidents must be resolved without foreign interference, and the countries of the region should follow the example of Iran and the armed forces of the Islamic Republic. I'm guessing your interpretation, obviously, of Iran's leader's statement there, but I'm guessing that Iran's motto of wanting to establish and maintaining friendly relations with the countries in the region has something to do with that. And, of course, the exercises is one of the reasons why it was held, is to make sure that it maintains stability there.
That's exactly true. Iran has never invaded any country, and its war games are always meant, and even its arms program, they are meant to deter threats. And when the Iranian leader said that he meant the growing ties that Azerbaijan has been having with Israel, as your other guest correctly mentioned. There are three issues here involved. First was the corridor that I just explained. Again, on both sides, on Azerbaijan side and Turkey side, you could see the foot trace of the Israeli regime provoking and inciting the two governments to go for such an ambitious plan. That would be a strategic mistake, of course. Iran, the drills show that Iran, you know, would take any such move very seriously and would step in, though war would be a last resort, and Iran has multiple more options. Yet still, if nothing works, then Iran would take immediate action. One of such options was offering Armenia to, you know, construct a new corridor that would start from Iranian borders to Yerevan for 400 kilometers. The only, you know, the first 20 kilometers of the old road that would go to the newly freed Karabakh region matters here, and Iran has offered to construct a replacement road and highway, and it's already involved in that. That means that Iran is very serious of that, sending Azerbaijan a serious message that Iran would have no hesitation to defend its interests in the region. Also, the militant groups deployed in Idlib in northwestern Syria, they've been transitioned to Karabakh region, and that's a very serious threat to Iran. And also, the Israelis have been given a very free hand recently, especially in the last few years, growingly. I mean, the Azeris have given the Israelis an airbase, and they have been using, the Israelis have been using that base for, as a platform to do hostile actions against Iran. They've been sending multiple drones to Iran. In many cases, they have been pushed back. They've, you know, failed in infiltrating Iranian skies. But in one, at least in one or two cases, they infiltrated Iranian territory, though the Iranian air defense was in the know. They had, you know, found out that that drone was coming in. They wanted to know where it's going and what's the mission, and it was shut down. It was a Hermes, Israeli Hermes drone that was sent by the Israelis to go for reconnaissance mission against Natanz. And when Iran held, protested against such a move to Azerbaijan, the Baku government claimed that they didn't know anything about it, that the Israelis had bypassed them. That means giving Israel a free hand, such a free hand that they would not even,
that's interesting,
you know, be bound to inform the Baku government. And also, many victims had infiltrated the Azerbaijan border with Iran. That's a very serious crime against Iran. In one or two cases, they have assassinated Iranian scientists. Let me give you this last example.
Okay.
Majid Jamal Majid, who was involved in an assassination of an Iranian nuclear scientist around a decade ago, he had been given a free pass to go to Israel via Azerbaijan and for receiving training, and he got back to do the assassination, and he did it, and he martyred one of the Iranian nuclear scientists. So Iran has had many grievances. It has, you know, exhausted diplomatic, and it's now sending very serious, you know, warnings to the Baku government that enough is enough, because Baku is going to give the Israelis more, you know, room, and at least they would allow them to have two, three new military bases that would definitely be used against Iran. And there is irrefutable evidence that Baku has been inviting Israeli war strategists like Brenda Schaffer, who's a Haifa University teacher and Israeli army strategist and FDD member, who is the theoretician of radicalizing ethnic Azeri nationality in order to decompose, okay, Iran.
Yeah.
That's a very, you know, she even released a picture of her presence on the other side of Khoda Afarin Bridge on Aras River, the border river between Iran and Azerbaijan, very proudly she declared her presence in there.
And to give more backing to what Mustafa Khoshesh has said there, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, the Azerbaijani Defense Ministry has said that it's denied allowing another entity, in this case Israel, or even the U.S. to use this airspace. And there was information, I guess, about Russia's container radar system that detected unknown planes using Azerbaijan's airspace. Again, the Azerbaijani Defense Minister denying that. How could that be when that seems to be the case?
Well, the Azeris clearly have tested the water. They've got bold after the victory, the quite comprehensive victory, actually, and the military hardware that they used was extremely and extraordinarily accurate and powerful. Now, Turkey was involved in the supply of those weapons, Israel itself, of course, as I said. So it could be that Mr. Aliyev has got delusions beyond his station and feels that he might be able to stake a claim in certain areas within Iran. But I rather suspect it's much more a case of the issue of the corridors and all these pipelines, these railway tracks. All of this links ultimately, let's not forget, to the Belt Road Initiative, which is the major lifeline, the major economic, lifeline for countries in that region. Now, Azerbaijan sits very critically at a very critical nexus or juncture of that Belt Road Initiative. And of course, the Americans, the Israelis, and such like forces wouldn't want that to be successful, especially if it involved the Islamic Republic of Iran benefiting at all. Of course, this is the crux of the issue. The Russia-China sort of strategic partnership, along with Iran and other nations, Pakistan included within that, they look for stability within this region. All of them will want stability. They'll be looking on at this situation with horror, because essentially this would give NATO and would give NATO's partners the perfect opportunity to put a spanner in the works of that part of the development, the economic development of that region. They would like nothing more than to be able to do that. So I think we're going to see a lot of behind-the-scenes involvement from the greater Eurasian partnership, as it were, to step in and to try and ensure that Azerbaijan doesn't go any further, and the legitimate concerns that the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown will be given great credence within that part of the world. And the economic factors, I think, will hopefully allow Azerbaijan to see sense, because they would profit from an equitable use of the corridors around Natchivan and the various railway routes.
All right, final question quickly, if you can, say Mustafa Hoshesh. So you would guess that here logic needs to prevail. One step should be taken back, tensions to be simmered down. But that would be very hard, given some of the facts that you have said about how, as you said, Azerbaijan being used as a base, even though the country's president and even the defense ministry says that's not the case. When will that red line be crossed, or will things get toned down? How will they get toned down, in your opinion?
Any further activity by the militants, any lack of action by Azerbaijan to take the militants back, to take the Israelis back, and any further hostile activity by Israeli regime against Iran through the Azeri territory, or any kind of effort by Azerbaijan and its allies to change geopolitical borders, would trigger Iran's reaction, definitely very tough and stern reaction. Let's remember that this kind of corridor, we are not talking about an economic corridor that would be welcomed by anyone, by everyone, but we are talking about occupation of territory. If that happens, and they've coined the word for that, Turkestan, then that means Turkey would find itself on the shores of the Caspian Sea. Turkey is a NATO ally. That means the expansion and spread of NATO to territories, not just threatening Iran, but also Russians. And we all know what the Russian reaction could be to the spread and expansion of NATO. We saw it in their reaction to such efforts in Ukraine. And also, the presence of militants is mainly a threat to Russia. That's why when Iran's martyred Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani convinced Putin that after establishing their presence in Syria and Iraq, that this militant groups, they would spread to Russian territories to pose threat to them. Putin was convinced to authorize military action against the militants in Syria. And then they know it pretty well. Though they are in good terms with Israel, the Russians know pretty well what kind of, plans are being pursued by the Israelis to make hotbed of tensions around Iran. And this means Iran's reaction. This means escalation of tensions and instability in the region that would be harmful to everyone, including Russia.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Thank you for your comments, Sayyid Mustafa Hoshesh, political analyst, and Simo Sinabas, thank you, journalist and political commentator there from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitaly and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And we are here sitting in the studio with two of my friends, and let me ask them actually to introduce themselves.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Habib, at your service from California of the United States of America, most expensive state in the United States, actually.
I see.
At your service.
Okay, thank you very much. And brother?
Assalamu alaikum, Muzaffar Haider here from the UK.
Oh, great. I always think of life as somewhere like a steep. We are not looking at some level ground, all right, which is flat.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, either you have to go up the mountain or come down the mountain or the hill. And usually when you want to do good things, the first thing that comes to mind is that it takes more energy and time and effort and patience to go up the mountain, right?
Yeah.
But coming down, you can even roll down, you know. It's like very, very easy, like in comparison with climbing up the mountain, all right?
Yeah, yeah.
Why is it, or why is life is like this? We also have it like in one of the, what you call it, the principles which are available in Islamic culture, is that you need to invite people to the good, all right?
Yeah.
As if it needs some kind of a push, isn't it, like this?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we do see that in life there are peaks and troughs. You're going up sometimes, you're coming down sometimes.
Yes.
Sometimes it's very difficult to achieve what we want to achieve, and sometimes it's very easy.
Mm-hmm.
This is the system that Allah has created, and incidentally there's a verse in the Quran that says, very few of my servants attempt the uphill struggle.
Yes.
You know, and he's urging human beings to attempt that struggle, because victory lies at the top of that hill. It's going to be difficult.
Yes.
And then he says, "Inna ma'al usri yusra." Surely with difficulty is ease. You know, if anybody out there, and I'm telling this to the young brothers out there especially, and sisters, that if anybody is telling you, just chill out, take it easy, don't worry about it, kick back and relax, and they never push you to achieve, this person is not actually your friend. There's a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says, your true friend is the one who tells you your flaws.
Right.
You might hate that person because you don't like people telling you your flaws. But when that person does that in private, inshallah, it compels you to be better. And it makes you aware that you have a flaw that you want to overcome. So when it comes to the idea of enjoining good in the society,
yes,
it's a very important thing.
Yes.
If we're not pushing others to be better, we should know that we're not actually being friends to them.
I want to comment on that. And because you're a linguistic and you like linguistic things, right? He said that the true sadiq, sadiq wa adu, the base of the words, sadiq is the one, it comes from sidq, from truthfulness. The reason why a person is a sadiq or a friend is because he is truthful towards you and towards your path. And adu, man i'tada, who hurts you. And the person that puts you astray from your goal and from the mission is adu. اعتدى عليك. He has harassed you. He has hurt you. So that's the reason why they call a sadiq sadiq and a adu adu. Because a sadiq يصدقك في القول والعدو يعتدي عليك. A sadiq or a friend is the one who is truthful towards you, and al adu is a man that or a thing that or a person that hurts you.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Brother Habib. Let's take a break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
I wanted to ask you the question about the other part of this principle that Brother Muzaffar kindly talked about, that part which was associated with enjoining the good. But what about forbidding the evil?
I think that this obligation, of course, you can separate or you could distinguish the obligations that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has lawed or made laws into different. Some things are personal, individual laws. Mm-hmm. Some things go with society and go with society, such as zakat, such as khums. Zakat, of course, alms, and khums, which is also the fifth that you pay. The one-fifth of your money that you pay for the sadat and for the imam saham sadat.
Right.
Now, the best example, like I said, would be for society obligations is al-amr al-ma'ruf an-nahy al-munkar. And one of the best reasons why, to answer your question, is that the bad apple, the rotten apple, if you put it with the good apples, it rots.
Right.
And as someone who bought apples for expensive price, me, and then put a bad apple between them, and then lost all the apples. So the thing is that if you have one person that is, let's say, spoiled, rotten, it rotten society altogether. That is why we have hudud, capital punishments.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if someone does adultery, There are capital punishments specified for that person. Mm-hmm. Someone steals also. Why? When the crowds come and look at the capital punishment, something happens to them. Mm-hmm. They have fear that this will be me one day if I do this. So they what? Stay away. Human beings are like rats.
It's just an example for the community, you mean?
Yeah, it's an example for the society. So when we forbid, we are doing it for the sake of our society and also the person that is being forbidden. The person that is being ordered for good, he has to keep it in mind that sometimes a nafs is very smart. A nafs is very, the shaitan is very clever also. Sometimes you forget. That you forget, it just takes one day to forget, even less. It takes a couple of seconds to forget, and then all of a sudden you slip. You forget. You're thinking, you know what's right, you know what's good, you know what's wrong. But sometimes it's not in your mind. Mm-hmm. It's not in your imagination that you're doing something wrong. This person could be advising you. He's doing good for you, right? So you have to be even more than just okay with it. You have to be thankful for that person that he's forbidding good.
Exactly.
So for the forbidding part is very important for the sake of society. When you see, for example,
you need to purify the society.
You need to purify society because you can't live in a corrupt society. I don't know about you guys, but I don't want to put my son in a corrupt society. I don't want to put my daughter. I don't want to have this fear for my daughter when she goes out by herself, for example, in a corrupt society.
Nobody wants to put this.
I'm just talking about myself because there might some people might argue for the sake of arguments.
I see, Brother Muzaffar, Brother Habib was very nicely talking about this important point: forgetfulness. When people tend to forget, because people are forgetful, you know? We individuals, we human beings are like, have it built in us, I guess. We are very much forgetful. And we need constant reminding. Or remembrance that we have to do this, we have to do that, we should do this, we should do that, you know? But sometimes it is not the forgetfulness, it is the negligence in the sense that, you know, people don't know, or one particular individual doesn't know that his action is harmful to other people around him or her. And do you think that in this sense that I use the negligence for, the word negligence, again, we need to keep reminding the person who's doing the harmful act to the society, to the people around him or her, in fact, to come back and be corrected somehow.
So the Holy Quran says, فَذَكِّرْ إِنَّ فَعَتَ الذِّكْرَ سَيَذَكَّرُ مَنْ يَخْشَى وَيَتَجَنَّبُهَا الْأَشْقَى.
Exactly.
It says, so remind. Surely the reminder helps, it benefits. The one who fears will be benefited by it, and the one who has nothing to do with it,
mm-hmm.
they won't be affected by it.
Yes.
But your job, your walifa, your duty mm-hmm. is to remind them.
Exactly.
Now, when it
so
comes
much
to
emphasis in the Quran on zikr.
Of course. Even the Quran itself is referred to as a zikr.
Exactly.
Right? Because in one sense, I mean, philosophically speaking, it's a really beautiful point. I just wanted to raise it that we know the reality, we've just forgotten it, and so we need to be reminded of it. We know that, for example, our God is one. We know that we're going to be brought back to Him. We know that this world is ending and we're going to go to the hereafter.
Mm-hmm.
We've just forgotten it, and sometimes we need that reminder. It's like when you're in a dream and you forget that you're dreaming.
Yes, and we're always forgetting our death. Just stay with us. Here sitting in the studio with two of my friends, Brother Muzaffar and Brother Habib. You need to invite people to the good, all right?
Yeah.
As if it needs some kind of a push.
And we forget our death, right? Even though every one of us knows we're going to die.
Saying of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, whenever I remember it, you know, it just brings shivers on my spine. He saw people going behind a funeral, and then all of a sudden they start to laugh. Amir al-Mu'minin starts to say, وَكَأَنَّ الْمَوْتَ قَدْ كُتِبَ عَلَى غَيْرِهِمْ, and that death has been written on other than them, and that there will not come a day where they will be underneath the soil, and that their money will be between the inheritors, and that their wives will get married, and that their houses will be sold, and that people will take away their wealth and their property. It just reminds me that, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm putting all my energy for this worldly matter, for this dunya. If you want to hate the dunya, you want to remember death, just read the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Exactly.
He knows how to touch where it hurts. He knows he knows how to explain it. Yeah, he knows how to touch it. Salamu Allah alayka, Amir al-Mu'mineen. Azakunallah ziyaratu. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless us with visiting his grave, inshallah ta'ala, in Najaf.
Allahi ameen, inshallah.
And yeah, like how you said, we forget. There's a verse also in the Holy Quran that states that the human being in his nature forgets.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Insan.
Yes.
What does insan mean?
From nisyan.
Some say that it comes from nisyan, which means to forget.
Yeah.
Our nature is forgetful.
Yeah.
That's how we've been hardwired
and
created.
Part of the other nature or the natural thing that characteristic that we have in all human beings, in addition to forgetfulness and negligence, is that we think, as you rightly mentioned, referring to the hadith from Amir al-Mu'minin, you know, peace be upon him, is that we think that everything else, as you mentioned, we are an exclusion. We are just an exception to the whole society or to other people. Like everything bad is going to happen, it's going to happen to other people and not us.
Yeah.
All right.
We're like the people in the theater, and we're just watching people's lives
go
on, and everything catastrophe, everything bad, everything that happens to them, it's for them. And we're just sitting down, we're living our lives, and we live for eternity. That's how we feel.
And it becomes very much obvious when it comes to death.
So a very interesting point. Yasin, Surah Yasin is something that we often recite for those who are dead.
Yes.
Somebody passes away, what do we do? First thing we do is recite the 36th chapter, Surah Yasin. We pop it out, we start reciting it. One of the verses actually says, لِيُنذِرَكْ مَنْ كَانَ حَيَّ. This book has been revealed to warn him who is
Alive.
Yes.
Right, so we're reading it, and often what the problem is, brother, is that we're reading it in Arabic and we're not understanding what we're reading.
Even Arabs, my brother, even us who study in Hausa sometimes, we kind of forget. I have to be honest about that. Or sometimes we don't pay attention. We all, and the Quran is a bahar, And the Quran's an ocean, a deep, 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 deep ocean. Unlimited knowledge is in it.
Yes.
We have to reflect. Every time you reflect, you can reflect about something else, about every verse. You stated this verse. The last time I reflected on that verse, I was thinking about knowledge. About knowledge and jahad, of course, because it has to do with the saying of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. So yeah, we don't just say non-Arabs. That's what I want to say. So even Arabs sometimes don't, pay attention and reflect correctly.
And interestingly, we have a Persian proverb that talks about reciting the Yasin to the ears of the donkeys.
It is a saying.
It's very nice. It's very interesting because it connotes that like you are beating the air, because it's not gonna, like, your advice not gonna have any impact on the person you're talking to, basically.
Yeah, yeah. But just because I know that the conversation's veering off a little bit, I just want to quickly put this point in here. When it comes to Nahya anil Munkar, you have to go and see what your marja says about it, because sometimes you have
the
to
laws and regulations that have to do with it.
You have to understand, is this thing that I'm going to do going to stop that evil from taking place or not? Right, sometimes it's not going to have any effect. Should you do it in that circumstance or not? You see, this requires more discussion and more contemplation.
Exactly. Thank you very much, Brother Muzaffar and Brother Habib, for joining us in the program Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al Alameen, يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رايزك
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رايزك لتصيد دلعتك once again.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the
world with reporters.
The hunger strike of six Palestinian prisoners who have refused to eat for days have once again brought the plight of Palestinian prisoners to attention. The six are on hunger strike to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them.
Israeli prison authorities refused to deal with the hunger strikers' legal demands. Kayed Al-Fosfos has been on a hunger strike for over 82 days. Mehdad Al-Ghawasmi for over 76 days, and both were transferred to Goblan Hospital. Ala Al-Araj as well has been transferred to Al-Ramlis Clinic. Their health condition is deteriorating, but they insist to continue with their move to end their illegal detention.
In solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah. Here, every week, you'll see prisoners' mothers and wives holding the pictures of their beloved ones. They say they are the voice of the prisoners.
My son Mujahid went on a hunger strike and ended it after the Israeli authorities decided not to renew his administrative detention and to release him. Mujahid spent almost 10 years in jail and then he was rearrested after 15 months of release. His administrative detention has been renewed 3 times. That's why he started the open-ended hunger strike. I know he was risking his life, but that was only for the hope that he could be released to live with us, his family, and to raise his only child.
Administrative detention is illegal, however. It's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, where 520 of them under the illegal administrative detention.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoner follows the same path in the future. Unfortunately, Israel ends the administrative detention only when hunger-striking prisoners are on the verge of death. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Tensions between China and Taiwan have once again escalated after Taipei reported that 148 Chinese fighter jets flew over the island's air defense zone since Friday. That was a day Beijing marked the founding of the People's Republic of China with a military parade. Taiwanese government officials said they have to be on alert for China's, quote, military activities, while Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen said the island would do what it took to defend itself. This is China regards a self-ruled island, a breakaway province waiting to be reunited with the mainland. It maintains sovereignty over the region under the One China policy. However, Taiwan says it's an independent country and seeks help from the West, especially the United States, to boost its defense. Currently, the U.S. is Taiwan's largest weapons supplier, despite having no formal ties with the island. On Monday, China once again lashed out at the U.S. for selling arms to Taiwan and sending its warship to the Taiwan Strait. The foreign ministry described Washington's actions as provocative and irresponsible and urged it to stop bolstering Taiwanese separatist forces. Some experts believe the U.S. is hatching plot to further push Taiwan into secession from China.
The U.S. is trying to push the envelope as far as possible, trying all kinds of tactics and measures to push Taiwan forward as if it was a separate country without declaring its former status as a separate country.
The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. Last week, London sent a warship through the Taiwan Strait for the first time since 2008. That despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over such moves. For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. But ties between Beijing and Washington deteriorated sharply under former President Donald Trump. China had hoped for an improved relation under Trump's successor, but since taking office, Joe Biden has maintained pressure on China, showing no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies. Biden is even seeking new alliances to counter China's rising influence in the region and beyond.
This is a crisis that was said to have blown over. It was supposed to be a gradual return to full fuel tanks and drivers reassured that the very worst was behind them. Those in England's southeast continue to be hit especially hard. And despite army personnel now helping with the distribution of fuel to forecourts most in need, Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng denied the UK was at crisis point.
The last few days have been difficult. We've seen large queues, but I think the situation is stabilizing. We're getting petrol into the forecourts.
For consumers, the minister's words may well ring hollow.
I just think it's embarrassing that, again, we live in the UK, that we have to get the army to drive trucks. So, yeah, ridiculous, ridiculous. I think it's what we just get used to now, isn't it? I mean, that's just how it is. This government's terrible. Preceding governments have been just as bad. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah, this shouldn't be happening in the UK today.
You should bring in foreign help. I mean, workers from abroad who actually know how to drive lorries and to carry the fuel to the pumping stations.
UK is a very big country and very rich country and a developed country. All this mess should not be like in your life since day one. So I really don't understand all this mess, really.
It should have been business as usual at these pumps, but for many drivers, they'll be wondering whether or not their reality is being matched by the rhetoric coming out of Downing Street, and worse still, if this is a shape of things to come. The government's had to admit that one of the solutions touted to alleviate the crisis, relaxing the visa rules for experienced EU HGV drivers, has underperformed.
What we said to the road haulage industry was, fine, give us the names of the drivers that you want to bring in and we'll sort out the visas. We got another 5,000 visas. They only produced 127 names.
The worry is that this fuel issue becomes a crisis of confidence in Britain's ability to deliver the basics for its citizens. This might leave more of a damaging legacy than the government cares to admit. Amina Taylor, London.
As the humanitarian crisis looms in Afghanistan, Yaron's new shipment of humanitarian aid to Afghan people containing tons of foodstuffs has arrived in Kabul. This round of Iranian aid was handed over by Iranian Red Crescent Society in cooperation with its Afghan partner.
The Iranian Red Crescent Society, in cooperation with the Red Crescent Society of Afghanistan, has sent the first consignment, which is including the 15 metric tons of the humanitarian consignment, mainly the food items, including the rice, canned beans, and as well as the macaronis and other sugar and other food items, which is necessary for the people in Afghanistan.
These aids are provided amid the rising hunger as a result of political crisis and the blockade of Afghans' assets by the U.S. Afghans and aid groups believe that the country wouldn't face the ongoing crisis if the U.S. had not frozen its assets.
We thank Iran and other countries who are helping Afghans these days. Our main concern is U.S. sanctions that are pushing people to unprecedented hunger and poverty. The U.S. and other countries must consider humanitarian needs and separate it from political issues. Many countries want to send money to the people of Afghanistan, but can't do that due to sanctions.
Our situation is really dire.
I have lost my job and I don't receive my salary anymore. I urge international countries to help poor Afghan people who have nothing to eat these days. Some are displaced and live on the streets.
2 decades of war have left Afghanistan impoverished. The U.S.-led war in the country came to an end in August when all foreign forces left Afghanistan.
Afghanistan is faced with a multitude of crises. Health clinics are closing down, while rampant inflation is treating people who have been left with little money and food. All that's against the backdrop of Afghanistan's frozen assets abroad. In such circumstances, assistance from the international community, especially the neighboring countries, will be a welcome relief for millions of Afghans. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
With the second shipment of Iranian fuel already making its way to most Lebanese areas, the electricity crisis has somewhat been lifted. Private generators and companies have welcomed the initiative by Hezbollah to bring in Iranian fuel through Syria.
We are buying diesel oil for a lower price. We are also buying it in Lebanese lira, and this fuel is for all sects and all religions.
Despite some criticism from foes of Hezbollah, the general response has seen the fuel as a form of humanitarian aid.
Lebanon's need for this fuel and the method with which Hezbollah distributed the fuel to all sectors and all factions in Lebanon has helped to strengthen the Lebanese society and its sovereignty. Hezbollah had been very careful not to negatively impact Lebanon in any way when it came to security and maintaining the unity of Lebanon, which is our priority. And so it was a very significant backup for Lebanon when it needed it the most.
Hezbollah Secretary General stressed previously that a bigger portion of this fuel will be distributed as donations.
This is one of the major petroleum stations in Lebanon, which was affected by the crisis. Today, it is the main distributor of Iranian fuel in the country. Several Al-Amana stations across Lebanon are responsible for the distribution of gas, either free or selling with a price cheaper than the market.
Experts believe there's more to the import of fuel from Iran than meets the eye.
This convoy of ships has proven that at any time when the Americans exit the region, there can be an alternative. And this alternative is not only military and political, it is also economic. And this is the upcoming challenge for our country and our communities. Even the U.S. and its agents have understood that the issue is not merely an issue of providing fuel, but that there is an alternative lead by the Islamic Republic of Iran in alliance and cooperation with all the countries in the region to free its economies instead of being under the U.S. hegemony.
Hezbollah has also noted that this initiative will not cover all hours of electricity, but that there needs to be reforms in the electricity sector, while some of the gasoline shortage should be met with the arrival of a third Iranian ship. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Pakistani politicians and former top civilian and military officials are in the spotlight after they were named in Pandora Papers scandal. There are as many as 700 Pakistani politicians, retired civilian and military officials whose names surfaced in the scandal. Among them also included sitting ministers and close aide to the Prime Minister Imran Khan, whose government came into power in 2018 with a pledge to end rampant corruption. Pandora Papers are based on 11.9 million documents from 14 firms, mostly in British Virgin Islands and the US, where many world leaders and top officials, including from Pakistan, hid their allegedly ill-gotten money by setting up anonymous offshore companies.
How ironic it is. Look at the sheer numbers of military generals and bureaucrats and members of current government who have been named in Pandora leak. They all are involved in this mega corruption.
Prime Minister Imran Khan has ordered an investigation into the scandal.
Although Mr. Imran Khan has been presiding over a team of these crooks and gangsters who have now been exposed in these Pandora's leaks. He has been closely working with these ministers whose names have come up. But at the same time, he would like to distance himself from these crooks and gangsters in the name of the so-called investigation that he's likely to initiate very soon.
Prime Minister Imran Khan's predecessor Nawashi was ousted from power in 2017 for possessing overseas assets beyond known means of their income after a similar scandal known as Panama Papers surfaced. Since then, many tax amnesty schemes have been introduced to legalize the hidden wealth of politicians and officials in and outside Pakistan in return of tax penalties.